Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
All right, John Anderson is undoubtedly one of the most recognizable voices in music as the lead vocalist and creative force behind Yes. Anderson was the author and a major creative influence behind the groundbreaking album Fragile, as well as a series of epic, complex pieces such as Awaken and Close to the Edge. Additionally, Anderson co-wrote the group's biggest hits, including I've Seen All Good People, Roundabout, and The Owner of a Lonely Heart. And after 55 years of success in the music business, John has worked with many variations of Yes, as well as collaborations with Vangelis and many others. He has released several critically acclaimed solo albums that have made an impact in progressive rock. In 2017, he was inducted into the Radio Hall of Fame as a member of Yes. John will be appearing at the Arcata Theater on Friday, May 12th, and at the Des Plaines Theater on Saturday, May 13th, with his Yes Epics and Classics. For tickets, you can go to oshows.com. And joining us is music legend John Anderson. John, welcome in, my friend.
Hey there, how are you doing?
I am great. You know, I was looking back, like first time performing in Chicago for you with Yes was in 1971, the Auditorium Theater, still here by the way. It was, isn't that amazing?
I remember it very well. It's a very wooden theater.
Yes.
Right? And I'm sure they have boxing there. And the people were throwing cherry bombs around.
Oh, God.
It was a great night. A lot of fireworks going on.
Wow. Well, you know, it's funny. It's been around since the late 1800s. It was home to the Civic Opera House, the Chicago Symphony. But 67 to 75, it was a rock venue. So, yes, Grateful Dead, The Doors. It's an iconic place.
Yep. Incredible. The sound was brilliant. You know, this on stage. You know, some theaters, or especially auditorium, is so big. You hear yourself on stage, and you don't know what it's going to sound like out there.
Right.
In that place, my God, it was a great sound.
You know, talk to us about those earliest days as a kid and in England. When did you know that music was going to be, you know, your mission in life?
Oh, boy. Diving deep here. You know, I was working on the local farm when I was 10 years old, delivering milk, milking cows with my brother. And he was 3 years older than me.
Okay.
And I just wanted to do it. I really liked the idea of serving, helping, whatever. And we used to sing Everly Brothers all the time.
Yeah.
This is like, you know, 1958, 59, sure. And the 60s came. And we're still working on a farm. And then my brother had a band, a rock and roll band called The Warriors.
The Warriors, yeah, right.
And he had a guy who sang with him. And the guy wanted to become a hairdresser, so he left the band.
Okay.
So I got the chance to be in the band. So that was really a crazy, wonderful time. We had an orange van with big horns, like cow horns. From, I don't know where we got them from.
Yeah.
And they could have impaled anybody. Police didn't care about that. And we toured all over England, and then eventually the Beatles came out. And that was a turning point for me and Tony, my brother. We just loved doing the Beatles songs. And we actually went to see them in 1963, just before they became mega famous.
Right.
And it was in a place called Southport, just north of Liverpool. And we just went on my brother's motorbike, and it rained all the way, but we kept singing. keep singing, it'll be okay, you know. And but the Beatles were playing when we walked in, and there must have been about 500 or 600 people, very young in those days, teenagers, and
sure.
No screaming until after the song finished.
Right. Okay, yeah, that's respectful. Probably wasn't happening later in their career or even in Yes, but yes, that's a real thing.
Yeah, 6 months later, we went to see them in our local town, Blackburn, 5 miles away, and we couldn't hear them.
Right, all screaming through the entire thing. I remember seeing that on Sullivan everywhere. I mean, you barely heard the song, but you got to see them, I guess, was the thing,
right? They were brilliant.
The Warriors you were talking about with your brother Tony, you know, there was a lot of notable musicians in there that obviously went on to do other things, but that was a pretty groundbreaking group in and of itself. But, you know, at that time, you know, you then Yes was formed, you know, where you were introduced to the late Chris Squire in 1968. And that was really the beginning, the very, very beginning of Yes.
Yeah. It was. I'm still trying to think of Bob Dylan.
That's right. That's right. I just looked it up myself. Yeah.
Ian Wallace went to play with Bob Dylan. And my friend Brian Chatton went on to play with B.B. King.
Yeah, there we go. There we go.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, that's pretty
cool.
So,
I was still on tour with the Warriors, and I wanted to really write some new music. For some reason, you know, a lot of acid and a lot of marijuana. And, you know, the Beatles had released Sgt. Pepper, and I wanted to do was create new music. And they kept shouting to me in the morning when I try to wake them up, come on, we've got to go on. And they said, John, just F off, would you?
No.
Collectively, they said that. So after 3 days of that, I actually went. went to Munich, eventually got to London, and I bumped into Chris Squire in a bar that I was working in, cleaning the glasses. And it was above a very famous rock and roll place called the Marquee Club. So you'd have Pete Townshend walking in and, you know, famous people, Jimi Hendrix, and I'd be cleaning the glasses and serving them a beer or whatever.
Wow, yeah.
And I thought, well, I like doing this. I was milking cows for a long time.
It sounded pretty good.
Now I'm serving these wonderful artists some whiskey or whatever.
Yeah.
And maybe I should be in the band. And then I met Chris, and that was a turning point. It was brilliant.
It was. And, you know, from doing all that, I mean, you were the guy, though, that had the ambition to make this work. I mean, you know, you were the guy that was solid on the ground, like, you know, writing songs, securing the gigs. That is really those early days and what made it so successful is you just had to stay on top of it.
Yeah, I think the turning point for us was we had a record, Fragile, and we went on tour of America and Canada, started with Canada and eventually America with Jethro Tull. And that's when you the world opened up. You know, you go in and play in front of 10,000 people. And I'd stand at the side of the stage watching Ian Anderson perform. Mm-hmm. And he is a great performer. And I'd stand there with my tambourine like that, and I didn't know much about performing so much. So it took a little while for audiences to enjoy us. And by the end of that tour, you know, we were going down very well as opening act. It was really good.
Yeah. You know, and you were, you know, your original songs, you were, you know, doing rearranged covers of rock, pop, blues, jazz, you know, very much in that very beginning. But then after a couple of years, there was a clear redirection of the music with the Yes album.
Yeah. I think we'd learned a lot together, and it just happened that we had Steve Howe in the band and Bill Bruford and Chris and Tony Kaye at that time. And we were very, very interested in structure, because I'd been listening a lot to classical music, Stravinsky, Sibelius, and all that kind of thing. And so I just started humming ideas and coming up with ideas, and why don't we try this? And then I'd hear Bill and Chris doing this thing on the bass and drum thing. And I said, hey, guys, could you do it again? What are you doing? Oh, yes, great. Mm. Could you change key? That Heart of the Sunrise.
Yeah.
It's like the beginning of that. And then you go into the song. And I realized, interestingly, that most of my songs are very, very simple. And a lot of them are all about love songs and things like that. And then at that time, Vietnam was around, and it was really dark. And I started writing, I've got it written down somewhere. Yours is No Disgrace.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And all those young people going to war in Vietnam, not knowing why they were there, et cetera, is like, gosh, stupid world we live in. And so you start writing about it in songs. Close to the Edge was, to me, it was close to the edge of realization. And it still is.
You know,
we're still stuck in various wars and problems with people.
But that's how much, you know, that, you know, music played such an important role and continues to. But like during that time, that was the place to express that and to share that with obviously other people that felt the same. I mean, the music, it wasn't just about the music. It was about what you were communicating as well.
Yeah, because I think when we started, yes, I was 27, I think. And I thought I was too old to be a pop star. So
no.
I'm just gonna get on with writing some music about, Starship Trooper, which was a book by a guy called Heinlein who wrote sci-fi books. And I was reading a lot of sci-fi at that time. So we were very, very creative, especially through the Close to the Edge period. It was kind of mind-blowing to me that we actually created something like Close to the Edge as a piece of music. And last night I was out with some friends and the waiter came over and looked at me and said, "You're John Anderson." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Close to the Edge." And he was about 18.
Oh, that's cool. Isn't that great?
This guy was 18 years old, called Chase. It was like,
that's cool.
Hey, we reach people in so many different levels in different times.
For generations and forever. Absolutely.
Such a blessing.
Well, we are talking to music legend John Anderson, and there's more with him next on 720 WGN. It's Dave Plyer here on 720 WGN. We are talking to music legend John Anderson. You know, Roundabout from Fragile came out in 71, speaking of that era, and you wrote it with Steve. And there's, of course, a story behind the lyrics. As we talked about, the lyrics were so important, the message was so important. But the success of that song cemented your place in rock history. Like, tell us about how that Roundabout came along.
Well, Roundabout was, we were driving on tour from Aberdeen in Scotland down to Glasgow, and there's only one road, and you go down, and there's 15 or 16 roundabouts. You have to keep going around this roundabout, next village, and so on. And the mountains were coming out of the sky because you couldn't see the top of the mountains. It was all cloudy. And I just wrote down, "Mountains are coming out of the sky. They stand there," sort of thing. And then we go around Loch Lomond and in and around the lake. I wasn't driving, I was in the back with Steve, and he had his guitar out, and we were putting together the song. So it just came out of nowhere, just write it down, and then you get to the studio, so, this isn't too bad, actually. I don't know what it means.
But that process, was taking those small ideas and making it into something. I mean, that's really how it's been all those years.
It's true. Just going through this experience of re-remembering Perpetual Change, which I'm going to be doing in 2 weeks' time on stage, and realizing, gosh, these are pretty interesting lyrics.
Yeah.
And I don't know what they mean so much, but they sound good.
They sound cool. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Well, we are talking to music legend John Anderson, and there's more with him next on 720 WGN. Dave Plyer here on 720 WGN. We are talking to music legend John Anderson. Part of your success, you know, is a lot about how these songs, these albums were produced, you know, tape manipulations, recording with a limited number of tracks before the invention of multi-track recordings. Yeah. It was groundbreaking at that time.
It was.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful story at the end of Close to the Edge, which was written probably in about 10 different sections. And we came to the last section, and we'd recorded it, rehearsed it, and then thought, okay, that was a good take. And what you had was on the tape machine, it was just a one inch tape. And Eddie Offer, the engineer, he would put a number on it. Okay, that's the part towards the end, and it's sticking on the wall. And he had all these pieces of tape coming down. It looked kind of cool. And it was a Friday night, and it's a story that I've told many times, but the cleaning lady from next door, Lizzie, came in to clean the studio.
Uh-huh.
Everybody get out of here, you know, clean it up here. And she left, and we couldn't find the tape.
Oh, man. Oh, no.
And we thought, oh, my God, we just spent the last six hours mixing it, and quick, it might be in the dustbin. And me and Eddie went outside, and it was raining, opened up the dustbin and started pulling out tape.
Oh, man. And he said,
"Oh, here it is, 26. And he got it, and he wiped it off with a towel and really cleaned it and put it on. And we all sat there like, oh, please play perfect.
Yeah.
And it was just the last chorus of Close to the Edge, and it sounded great.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, and you did a lot. Here's the thing, too. You did a lot of solo albums in the mid-70s. Not many artists have great success with solo albums after being part of group or continuing as part of group.
Yeah,
but you did just that, and maybe bigger than most, and that has really been a thread throughout your entire career.
Yeah. Thanks for asking.
Yeah.
I think basically we were on tour Close to the Edge, and was it Topographic? I think it was Topographic. And Chris said, I'm going to make a solo album. And Steve said, and so am I. And I said, okay, I will.
I will too, yeah, okay.
And but I had this idea. A friend of mine, Tony Colton, who was the producer of our second album, Time and a Word, he came round to my house in London, and I said, I haven't seen you for a long time. He says, I've been to music school for the past 4 months. I've been learning about music. And I said, well done, Tony. And he got to the piano, started playing the piano. I said, my God, well done. And I thought about that. I should go to school, music school. So what I did, I had a lot of instruments I'd collected over the years in my garage, and harp and koto and flutes and drums and all sorts of stuff, shaker. And so thankfully I found this engineer called Mike Byrne, and it's probably the wrong name, but Mike, it was Mike. And I spent 3 months learning all this music for an album called Elias of Sun Hilo. And there was a story to it, and there was, gosh, I just went through so much creativity, if you like.
Oh, that's cool.
And it was a great feeling to finish the album, and the album did very well in the UK, and a lot of fans of Yes liked that album. And since then, I just, every other year, I'll do another album, maybe now with other musicians and different kind of musicians. I met Vangelis.
Right.
And right. I thought, hey, Vangelis, let's write an album. Anyway, it took a week.
Yes. Amazing.
He's an incredible musician, as everybody knows. And that was a joy to do. I was very, very pleased to meet and know Vangelis. When I finished my solo album, Elias of Sun Hilo, I played it to him first.
Interesting. Okay.
I just wanted him to like it.
Yeah, got it. Got
and
it.
He kind of looked at me and said, well done, Johnny.
And that was done, I think that first collaboration was in 1980. I think that you first did that. So I love that you wanted to and continue to like collaborate with other people, because it keeps your creativity going. Like, you know, when you're playing with the same people, you know, over and over, of course you're gonna write great songs and have fun performing together, but to kind of get out there and do something a little different, it's got to fill your soul.
Certain repetition goes on, and sometimes the energy of the people you're around, everybody changes in life.
Sure.
You know, sometimes we're all in a van. Oh, we're going to take over the world, you know, and then everybody's flying in their own plane.
That's right. So, that's right.
Not quite.
I get you.
But the idea is that you become slightly open to other things. And I've been so fortunate over the years. I did an album, say, 6 years ago with Jean-Luc Ponty. Incredible musicians that he works with, and to spend a 3 month period in my life with him and the band and tour and make an album is magic.
Absolutely.
And I'm just like that. You know, I enjoy. Actually, when the computer came through with MP3s, which is maybe 15 years ago, I just sent an email to Chris and Steve and said, MP3s, we can make music without being in the same room.
That's true. Well, that's true.
Anyway.
Well, we are talking to music legend John Anderson, and there's more with him next on 720 WGN. It's Dave Plyer here on 720 WGN. We are talking to music legend John Anderson. So Yes essentially disbanded in 81, then within 2 years back together. Owner of a Lonely Heart came out. Massive, massive hit. Number one on the charts. Let's get the background on all this, and let's talk about Trevor Rabin, who at that time was a South African singer and composer. And that's kind of how that song and his part of the band came about.
Yeah, actually, at that time they were recording, I was in the south of France. I'd met this wonderful artist, painter from Russia, a guy called Marc Chagall, who I didn't really know. It was his
Chagall,
90th
yeah.
birthday, and I went there with Bill Wyman, who lived nearby, and I just liked the guy. You know, he was such a sweet-looking guy, and he invited me to his house, and I started going to his house, looking at his paintings. I couldn't believe this guy, and then I learned about his stained glass work and all. Oh, incredible guy! So I, next 2 weeks later, I took my guitar along and sang him a song that I wrote for him, and then I write another song for him, and. He said, "What are you doing with the songs, John?" I said, "I'm going to write a musical about your life." And he said, "Well, musicals take time, you know," because he knew Stravinsky and people like that, incredible amount of people he knew in his life. And I just said, "No, I'll get it done next year." And like 40 years later, I just did a short version of it in San Francisco a month ago. Can you imagine? And he was right.
Wow.
Musicals take time. So
Yeah.
I was going back to, after about that period of time, I went back to London, see my family, make sure everybody's having a good time, life is good. And Chris rang me up and said, "John." And I went, "Who's that?" "It's Chris." "Oh, Chris, how are you?" I have to say that. And he said, "I want to play you some music." And I said, "Okay." So he came around with his beautiful Rolls Royce, and I jumped in the seat with him, and he started playing me this music. And it was kind of funny because I'd heard an album by the Sex Pistols manager, Malcolm McLaren, and the producer was this Trevor Horn guy, and I didn't know who he was. And I said, "This is really, really, re Chris, this is really good, okay?" And he said, "I thought you'd like it." And I said, "Who's producing?" He said, "Trevor Horn." I said, "Ah, you've got a really good guy." And Trevor Rabin is from where? South Africa. Oh, good. You've got these. Actually, it's brilliant. This music is brilliant. So what do you want to do? He said, "Well, we'd like you to sing on it." And I
Oh, that's
said,
cool. Yeah.
"Oh, thank you. Let me think about it. Okay, I will." I'm not a fool. This is
No.
brilliant music. An Owner of Lonely Hearts. So the following day, I went in the studio and me and Trevor met. And I sort of, the song that they had for it was a little bit more just a song that had a sort of verse that kind of lazy lyric, you know. And I said, "You know, that kind of lyric would be better. Live yourself. You always live yourself, never thinking of the future." And he's writing it down. He said, "That's good, John. I'll let you do it. Get on." So I just got on with writing it that day and sang it and everything. And you know, you think this sounds like a number one.
Did you think that? Did you think that
Yeah.
initially?
Oh, I did. Yeah,
Oh, that's
I
cool.
honestly did. And so did the record company. And of course, they financed a brilliant sort of video of us all turning into animals and birds and things. And it became a number one hit around the world.
Well,
And
it was that music video. You talk about that video and
yeah,
the dawn of MTV. I mean, this was all
MTV
aligning up.
started. Yeah,
Yeah.
MTV kicked in, and you know, we went on tour, and it was wonderful chaos to
Yeah.
me. You know, just to be screamed at. I think they
Yeah,
said, "Get off the stage."
exactly. No, it was not. It was not. It was
You
not.
know, that kind of thing.
But that was, I mean, that was just such a pivotal, time for the band too. I mean, and this is, you've already been around since the late 60s and boom,
Yeah.
this big hit and just kind of reinforces. And then people, when that, something like that happens, it does, allow people to go back and even look at the earlier works and become an even bigger fan, right?
That's what I found. You
Yeah.
bump into people in a bar after the gig or something. "Oh, I can't believe you do da 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 da." And then I've heard "Awaken." What the hell? you were doing that music. We mm-hmm. did. I didn't know that. Mind you, he was 12.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Fair.
It didn't matter.
Yeah. Cinema won, yes, a Grammy in 85. You know, where did the name Cinema come from? You know, share that story if you would, please.
That was Chris and Trevor.
Yeah.
You know, the Chris had done Drama, which was a drama
yeah.
album. And then, you know, I think Chris and Trevor came up with it and after a glass of whiskey or something like that.
I like that.
Whatever.
Like that. Yeah, yeah.
Whatever it takes.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and plus, over the years of Yes, I mean, you know, you're in, you're out, somebody else is in, you're out. You know, so many times yeah. over the history of Yes. And as yeah. a founding member, at what point were you like, you know, it's time for me to be me and do something else?
No, when I was in hospital.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, when you're on stage doing shows and you forget about the smoke that's around.
Yeah.
And they had this special smoke for the laser beams and all that kind in the 80s and stuff. And I was inhaling all that stuff. Yeah. And there was a point in time towards the end of the 80s where I really got sick. And I got very, very ill and collapsed and died in my wife's arms. And she saved my life.
Amazing.
And you think, I think I just got to, I don't want to tour like this. You know, because I spoke to the guys later and said, why don't we do an acoustic album?
Yeah, yeah.
And we could be on stage acoustic and we could just so brilliant. And yeah. Oh, yes, John. Okay. And that wasn't going to happen. So I just said, I cannot continue anymore. I'm going to take a back seat.
Yeah, take a time out.
Good luck with your life and so on. And actually, they got a singer and went on tour. And I thought, and I said to my wife, Jane, I said, you know, I've always wanted to do a solo show. And I got my guitar. I started practicing and writing some songs and did an album of song ideas with some friends and went on tour, even doing Yes songs with the guitar. I had a ukulele. I've got two over there. And I learned Day in the Life on ukulele.
That's just cool.
Which is kind of cool, you know? You know, can you all sing this with me, please?
Yeah.
To about, you know, I'd play in front of 1,000 people every show, wherever I went, all over the world. And got them to sing along with
That's cool.
my ukulele.
That's cool. Well, you're going to be at the Arcata and the Des Plaines Theater in mid-May here in Chicago. Uh-huh. So, you know, like, what plays the role of your choice of songs when you're putting together a set list? Because, I mean, really, it's very vast. You know, between Yes, your solo career, Vangelis, yeah. like, you know, how do you put it all together and say, yeah, this is what I'm going to do? Does it change from show to show? You know, do you just manipulate it just a little bit to have some fun?
I'll let you know.
Okay.
I'll call you. I think the thing was, you know, about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, a friend of mine who works at Sirius Radio, John Hammack, he sent me a video of this band playing Yes music. And I'd seen some other bands playing Yes music, but this was different. It was like so Yes of the 70s. I think they were playing Heart of the Sunrise, something like that. I was mesmerized how good they were. And I'd always thought it would be nice to go on tour again doing the songs and music of the 70s. At the back of my mind, I thought about that. And so I got in touch with Richie Castellano. Hard to remember his name there. Terrible. Mm-hmm. Richie, the bass player, who actually runs everything in that sense. And I just spoke to him on the phone and said, hi, Richie, I think your band is wonderful. Shall we go on tour?
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, and Richie, are you still there?
I bet you that was amazing. Tour.
You yeah. know, what we should do is like some epics and classics, because I want to do, you know, Awaken. I want to do Close to the Edge. I want to do the other one, one of them.
Okay, Roundabout maybe, or yeah.
Roundabout, yeah. But yeah. The classics are Yours and Grace, Starship Trooper, Honor of My Heart, and then Heart of the Sunrise, and Perpetual Change. You know, these are great songs to sing. So I've been rehearsing that for the last month, and I'll be seeing them for the first time next week.
Love that. I love that. Well, John will be appearing at the Arcata Theater on Friday, May 12th, and at the Desplaines Theater on Saturday, May 13th.
Yes,
with his
Yes,
I love Ron Onesti. Yes, epics and classics. And
yes,
for tickets, tickets go to oshows.com. I know Ron's a great guy, and he really deep down embraces, the legends of rock at his place.
He's special.
Yeah.
He's special. You go to that place, it's love. There's a lot of love around that place. Every time I played there, I was there a couple of years. Actually, I was there last August with all the teenagers from the Academy of Rock.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It was great.
It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
We're going on tour this summer around Europe, would you believe?
Very, very cool.
Working with teenagers is like breath. The fresh air on so many different levels. It's
I'm sure it fills your soul. I mean, to be able to share that with them, right?
You betcha.
Yeah. Yeah. John, absolute pleasure. And I really can't wait to see you here in Chicago.
Thank you. I wish you well and take care. And the snow is gone.
So I hope so. Thanks, John.